Support for our podcast comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering precision cancer treatment guided by advanced genomic testing through its new Centers for Advanced Individual Medicine. Advanced genomic testing may reveal treatment options that were not considered previously. Learn more at cancercenter.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, famed Berkeley exoplanet hunter Jeff Marcy was accused of sexual harassment by four former students. The story of the allegations unfolded quickly, with both Marcy and Berkeley issuing statements, and yesterday, Marcy resigned his position. My next guest broke the story. She's here to expand on the developments and other selected short subjects in science. Azeem Gureshi is a science reporter for BuzzFeed News here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about it. How did you get the information?
Well, so basically last year, four students, like you said, brought forward complaints to the University of California, Berkeley, saying that at various instances across almost a decade, from 2001 to 2010, Professor Marcy had sexually harassed them. An investigation went forward, a six-month investigation that concluded that Marcy had, in fact, violated sexual harassment policies. But the university's disciplinary action that they notified people about at the end of September was actually, to them, rather disappointing. The university said, essentially, we know that he violated policy. We've put him under probation. They didn't really mention what sort of restrictions he would be put under. But, you know, basically, he's going to continue to teach here. So I think they were pretty upset about that. And they came to us.
And he felt the pressure eventually and resigned.
Yeah, I mean, it happened very quickly, basically. We wrote the story. We talked to three of the four complainants, and it published last Friday. And then there was sort of an outpouring of support on Twitter, across social media, of astronomers saying, you know, this is a huge problem. This has been an open secret for years. This extends far beyond Dr. Marcy to other individuals as well. And basically, then the faculty released a letter on Monday saying that they didn't want him to teach there anymore.
When you say other individuals, are there going to be other revelation?
I mean, we'll see, I guess. There's certainly, I think, more awareness now and more sort of openness in talking about sexual harassment is obviously complicated, and especially when it's wrapped up in the power dynamics of academia and in astronomy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's less than 15% of tenured professors are female. So yeah. It's particularly, I think, prone to a lot of the problems that we already see in academia in general.
You know, this reminds me of the story that came out about chemist Tim Hunt making sexist comments.
Yeah, I mean, we were, to be honest, I deleted my Facebook because I was a little bit worried about sort of after the Tim Hunt stuff, there sort of was this outpouring of sort of, you know, you destroyed this great scientist's career, despite the fact that he had clearly held these beliefs that were, you know, very offensive towards his female colleagues. And I mean, here we've really just seen that everyone acknowledges that this is a huge problem and that we can't really tolerate this anymore, that this is not sort of how we want science or any sort of workplace to work in 2015.
Yeah. Whatever happened to those students? Did they stay in the field?
Some of them did. Some of them, one of the complainants told me she left altogether because of her frustration in dealing with Marcy's harassment, but then also just sort of the power dynamics in general. Others left as well. But some of them, I mean, one of the women I spoke to is a postdoc at MIT. She went to Harvard after she left Berkeley. You know, these are extremely, extremely bright women. If they choose to leave, it's because something pretty bad happened.
These are such unfortunate stories
in
science. Next up, a popular sterilization implant that may have some safety issues. Let's talk about that a little bit.
So this is the Assure device. It was approved in 2010. It was actually sort of a rushed approval, an expedited approval on the part of the FDA because it was totally novel. So instead of having a tubal ligation where you are put under anesthesia and have to undergo surgery, this is a totally non-invasive metal and cloth coil. One is put in each of your fallopian tubes. And basically, it works by causing scar tissue to build over it and blocking eggs from getting into the uterus and getting fertilized and then implanting in the uterus. The problem is that basically more and more women have come forward complaining of adverse events. There's a Facebook group now with over 20,000 women in it, all of whom they have mm-hmm. events ranging from bleeding to it dislodging to miscarriages to pregnancies. So it's actually fairly serious. And there's a new finding this week in the British Medical Journal showing that you're nearly 10 times as likely to go through a second procedure if you get the Assure device implanted versus getting a tubal ligation. And this is all sort of coming to a head right now because at the end of September, the FDA held a hearing where they basically had these women come in and tell them what the problems were. Mm-hmm. And so they're sort of reconsidering whether this device should have been approved in the first place, whether they need to do more research, whether there's something wrong with it
wow.
or that we don't know about.
Wow. More on that. Next up, the science behind climate change is complicated. And I saw this one myself. The IPCC might not be helping the case
yeah,
by how they explain it right,
yeah.
to the average person.
Right. So basically, these researchers did a linguistic analysis of IPCC reports over the years and showed that basically, based on this reading ease test that looks at the length of sentences and the complexity of words, the IPCC reports have actually been getting more and more unreadable over the years. And, you know, newspaper, magazine, and tabloid reports have stayed fairly stable. So, obviously, this is a problem. These are not intended. I mean, they're not intended for the layest audience, but they're also not meant to be just written for scientists.
Yeah.
So they're sort of trying to combat this by enlisting science writers and graphic design people to, like, hopefully be able to make
yeah. it. I have a few names
readable.
To give them if they're looking for
yeah.
science writers, because I read this and I've been reading this stuff for 40 years and I had to go through word by word and
yeah.
parse this out
yeah.
to it's- see. It was a very tough thing to read.
It's not easy stuff.
Your last story looks at doggy dementia?
Yeah. So doggy dementia is a thing that exists, sadly. It's called cognitive dysfunction syndrome, canine dysfunction syndrome, sorry. Mm-hmm. And basically, we don't know that much about how it progresses. So these researchers looked at 214 dogs between the age of 8 and 16 and a half. And they looked for the symptoms developing. They talked to their owners and looked at symptoms. Basically, what happens is the dogs start aimlessly walking, sort of mindlessly staring. Their spatial orientation is off. They pee all over the place. Sometimes they have intense personality changes. So they sort of went through all of these different symptoms and looked at sort of the rate at which it progresses. And they actually found that it progresses 5 times faster than in humans. And sort of this new rating scale will be used by vets to hopefully be better able to diagnose canine dysfunction syndrome earlier on. And there's actually a medical treatment. There's a drug that is a Parkinson's drug, actually, that can be used in dogs. Like, you can also have more preventative measures, like a more stimulating environment earlier on in the dog's life to sort of prevent it from progressing.
Poor doggies.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. All right, Azeem, thank you very much for joining
you.
Us today. Azeem Gureishi is a science reporter for BuzzFeed News here in New York. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And this summer, President Obama announced he would reestablish the embassy in Cuba, hoping to restore diplomatic ties. Another sign that the island country might be opening up, the Cuban government launched public Wi-Fi hotspots. What are the upside and downside? What's the upside downside of bringing that once disconnected country online? My next guest is here to discuss that. Jonathan Katz is a journalist based out of Durham, North Carolina, who has recently visited Cuba. Welcome to Science Friday.
It's great to be here.
Well, doesn't Cuba already have its own internet system? What's good about upgrading that?
Well, it has a little bit, but it's been very restricted, the number of people who can access it. And now more people are getting online. And the first good thing about that is just that, you know, the internet's awesome. Who doesn't like the internet? You got movies, books, sum total of all human knowledge available in a thing you carry in your pocket, access at all hours of the day. So that's pretty good. You can use it to make money. Cuba's economy has been really stagnant. This is, of course, a controversial thing to talk about in a socialist communist country, but people have been hurting because of the economy, and some people are already using the internet to make money in small ways. They resell the cards that you use at the hotspots to get online, which are already quite expensive. There's a thing called the paquete semanal. It's a weekly package of about a terabyte of movies and shows and stuff that people copy from hard drive to hard drive, and people are paying for that, and the distributors are making some money. There's even a Cuban Craigslist. It's called Revolico, and people are using that to make money in ways in Cuba that wouldn't have been possible even just a couple of years ago, and mm-hmm. no one knows where that's going to go. It's going to be awesome for us. I mean, Cubans are super ingenious people, and we just imagine the Cuban artists and the filmmakers and especially the musicians, the dancers, you know, who are going to show up on YouTube at some point in the future. That's going to be wonderful. And the last good thing is that Cubans are going to be able to connect with one another. This is really huge because so many Cuban families have been separated from one another over the years. You know, it seems like every Cuban family has at least one foot in the United States, often in Miami. And when I was in Cuba working on this story, I heard about, you know, the grandmothers who are going to these Wi-Fi hotspots just to see their grandchildren for the first time on these video connections. So that's going to be a really beautiful thing.
So what could be the downside of any of this?
Well, the internet's terrible. Governments governments use it to spy on their own people. People use it to spy on each other. It could very well end up being just another means of state control for the Cuban government. And even though, you know, we talk about the U.S. firms like Google who are trying to get into Cuba, right now it's actually Chinese companies that are doing the concrete work there. And that's the model that Cuba's most likely to follow. Although, you know, when I asked Cubans about this, a lot of them pointed out that I should direct my questions about internet surveillance to the NSA. It could also cause different kinds of instability. Now, the Cuban government's been worried about this in a very self-serving way, but it's a real concern. I mean, the United States government, before this normalization began, was expressly trying to use the internet in ways to basically bring down the Cuban government. A lot of people forget that the reason why Alan Gross, the USAID contractor who was in prison for 5 years and was let out on the day the normalization was announced, he was there in prison because he had been trying to bring illegal internet connections to synagogues in Cuba. Mm. And so, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, even just, you know, as journalists, like, we know the way that the internet can disrupt our lives in small ways just because it changes industries and there's no new economic model. So there could be another Cuban revolution of some kind, and that could cause some pain for a while. And then the last thing is, not necessarily everybody's going to share in the benefits. I mean, getting online is really expensive. It costs $2 to $3 an hour in a country where the average income is about $20 an hour.
Wow.
It's been used as a tool for elites, and a lot of people are probably going to miss out on it still.
Hey, Jonathan, I know you'll be following it for us. Jonathan Katz, journalist out of Durham, North Carolina. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm taking a tour of the Lower East Side. Hope you'll come along with me. We'll talk about it after this break.
Support for the Science Friday podcast comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering precision cancer treatment guided by advanced genomic testing through its new Centers for Advanced Individual Medicine. Every cancer, like every patient, is different. Advanced genomic testing can help our doctors understand each patient's cancer at the molecular level and may reveal treatment options that were not considered previously. Learn more about the promise of precision cancer treatment at cancercenter.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, one of the perks of working in Manhattan is that I get to commute through the world's most beautiful train station, Grand Central Terminal. It's got these huge glass windows, gorgeous blue-green ceilings painted with nighttime constellations. Only most mornings, there is really no time to admire the artwork. I'm too busy dodging the streams of commuters sprinting to catch a train or trying to avoid the tourist blocking traffic with his selfie stick. Navigating Grand Central is literally running an obstacle course and can leave your pulse racing. My next guest knows this kind of urban stress all too well. Colin Ellard is a cognitive neuroscientist. He studies how the built environment, that's everything from our city grid to our storefronts, affect us mentally and physically. In his new book, Places of the Heart, he talks about what science could and should contribute to urban design. Colin Ellard directs the University of Waterloo's Urban Realities Lab, and he joins us from Toronto. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be here.
And now I understand you started your career studying animals. How did you make the jump to the human-animal architecture?
Well, it took some time, Ira. I actually began my scientific career as the probably the world's leading expert on the visual system of the Mongolian gerbil. And I reached a point in my career where I felt like I wanted a bit more. I've always been interested in problems of space, how animals select habitats, how they avoid predators. And at some point, I decided that I wanted to look at animal architecture. So I looked at things like termite mounds and burrows. And although they may be interesting from an engineering point of view, for a psychologist, they weren't all that exciting. And I thought, if only there was an animal that built interesting structures that might tell me something about their spatial brains. And it took me a little while to figure out that that animal, of course, is us. So about 10 years ago, I made this transition to studying the psychology of urban and architectural design.
And in that last 10 years, you've had a lot of new tools added to your toolbox to study how we experience space. Tell us about some of those tools.
Sure. Well, one of the things that that we spend some time with is using the tools of immersive virtual reality, which is a great toolkit for being able to produce fairly highly controlled situations where people feel as though they are immersed in some space other than they are. But as great as they are, one of the downfalls of virtual reality is that it's not actually real. So what we're doing much more of now is measuring the behavior of people in real settings, both in interiors and in urban streetscapes. And there as well, there's all kinds of fantastic new technology now that we can use to measure not only people's psychological states, but the states of their bodies and their brains as well. So highly mobile sensors, for example, that can measure people's stress and arousal levels and even their brain waves as they're walking down a street.
Mm-hmm. And you started leading volunteers on walking tours of major cities like New York, Mumbai, Berlin. And what did they do? How does that work?
Well, on one of our typical walks, which we're still running now, we're running an experiment in Toronto at the moment. We invite people to take about an hour-long walk with us. They carry smartphones that ask them questions, sometimes simple questions like, how much do you like the setting? How complex do you find the setting? We also use the phones to administer different kinds of tests as people are walking. So, for example, we have a test of attention where people have to pay very close attention to a set of numbers that appear on the screen on the smartphone. And so we can use that as kind of an index to tell us how distractible the particular setting is that they're in. At the same time, people are wearing really simple bracelets. They just look like wristwatches, but they allow us to measure something called skin conductance, which is important because it gives us kind of a window into the state of a part of the nervous system called the sympathetic nervous system. Think of it as kind of like the fight or flight response. And so this bracelet lets us tell, allows us to determine how stressed and aroused people are in different kinds of settings.
And so as they walk around, they look around and they describe how stressful the settings are where they're going?
They describe the setting in words. They describe the setting using a series of rating scales. And at the same time, we're measuring their physiology. So we have a chance to compare how they think they feel with what their body's actually telling us.
Well, earlier this week, I was not outfitted with any of those fancy testing monitors, but I did follow one of your tour routes through New York's Lower East Side. And I took some stops that you suggested, and my first stop was a city green space. We're at a community garden at the Sarah D. Roosevelt Park in historic Lower East Side of New York. If you look into the garden, it really makes you forget that you're in the Lower East Side a bit. It is beautifully taken care of. There are park benches. There's a place to play chess, sit and relax, and plenty of greenery. And when you look around, you can clearly see that people have been gardening in this garden all summer. I would describe my physical state as being relaxed, vacation-y, and very much feeling in one with nature here. Colin, surprised by my reaction? Normal?
Not
average?
Yeah, absolutely normal. That spot where you where you were was such a treasured find on that walk. We really didn't expect to find anything that tranquil, that kind of oasis of green space on the walk. And one of the key findings that we've made in every city that we've studied is that immersion in those kinds of green spaces, even if it's only really brief, like just a couple of minutes of sitting on a bench, has a remarkable effect not only on your mood, but also on how you pay attention and your physiological stress levels. They just drop through the floor. It's a really profound effect.
Yeah, it is true. You just walk in there and suddenly you're in a different place. You write about a study that suggests views of nature can even help people recover from surgery.
Absolutely. This was one of the key findings. This was now some decades ago, but it was one of the main experiments that made people kind of rethink the profound effects of exposure to green space. And quite simply, what was done was to compare the recovery rates of two sets of surgical patients, all of whom had undergone surgery for the gallbladder. So serious, but not life-threatening. And the comparison was between individuals who had rooms with a view of nature through the window to those who didn't. And the main findings were that people recovered more quickly if they had views of nature and required less pain medication while they were recovering.
Wow. Wow. Can you actually measure that in a laboratory situation, or is that just something from hospital research?
Yeah, you can. You can. We've, for example, done experiments where we've looked at the effects of, again, immersing people in virtual reality simulations of natural settings. And we've found effects that are at least as big as some of those that have been reported in the real thing, which is kind of scary in a way. But you can also elicit some of the same kinds of reactions just by simply showing people photographs of natural scenes and comparing them to urban scenes. We see some of the same kinds of effects.
I guess that's why doctors' offices have fish tanks and things in them
sometimes. That's absolutely why they're there.
Yeah. Let's go on my next walking tour. This was a lot of fun. Now, my next walking tour was, believe it or not, the facade of a Whole Foods store. Why did you send me there?
The poor Whole Foods store. We use that setting because we're very interested in the influence of building facades on people's behavior and on their mood. If you think about your experience as an urban pedestrian, you know, when we think about architecture, we often first think about what's going on inside the building and what it's for. But as a pedestrian, what you're actually exposed to is the skin of the building. And there's a great deal of variability in how that kind of skin is organized in an urban experience. The Whole Foods facade, as you likely noticed, is kind of blank. It's closed. There's not much going on, not much to see. And we wanted to compare that facade style with something that was more open and engaging and filled with windows and views and activity on the street.
Yeah, well, that certainly was the case, as you'll hear on my stop at that store. We're in front of the Whole Foods store on Houston Street in the Lower East Side, and this has a completely different vibe to it. This really says no park, no greenery. This is really New York. Frosted windows on the store. There are barricades in the street, lots of traffic. I'm not excited at all by this location. The only thing that excites me is the pumpkin ale I can see through the window. That was the most exciting thing. It was really a bleak storefront.
Yeah, it really is. And it's, you know, when you look at the measurements that we've seen from people while standing in that location, again, they're fairly miserable. And you can even see it if you stand there and watch the behavior of passersby. They tend to speed up. They kind of hunch over, not looking at anything because there's nothing to look at. They don't pause. They don't look around. And in laboratory simulations of those kinds of settings, one of the things that we've done is to measure facial expressions, and you can even pick up a little bit of a whiff of anger on people's faces. They're bored, they're unhappy, and we think that that has kind of follow-on effects to people's physical health.
Hmm. Well, my next stop that you sent me on certainly drew an expression you can see on our website. And I was taken to an intersection of really two big streets in the Lower East Side. We're at the corner of Allen and Houston Street in the median, where all this traffic and construction is going on. You can hear it around me. Across the street from the famous Jonas Schimmel Conischery. And it's very, very congested here, with officers conducting traffic. This is not certainly a place you would come to relax. I feel very congested. I want to get out of the street. I'd rather go buy a knish. It was a good one. You know, great condition. It was a very stressful place to be, you know?
Yeah.
And I understand, though, that you led a walking tour through Mumbai, where a lot of urban dwellers were not very good at monitoring their own stress. I felt stressful, but you're saying that they said they did not feel stressful.
Well, there was an interesting dissociation there. What happened was when I arrived in Mumbai to run the experiment, I remember on my first day in the city, never having been there before, being completely shell-shocked by the pedestrian experience with the congestion, the noise, and especially the traffic. So even crossing a road requires something a little bit like parkour as you're running in front of the moving vehicles because they never stop. And so out of curiosity, I asked Mumbikers how they negotiated those kinds of stresses. And they said, oh, well, it's no big deal. You just get used to it. And so we turned our instruments on them to measure their bodies and determine the truth of that. And we discovered that their levels of physiological arousal were just as high as mine and those of other visitors. So people may feel that they've become accustomed to something, but their bodies are telling a different story. And that's really important because it's those bodily variables that, again, are influencing your psychological state, your well-being, and ultimately your physical health.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. We're talking about stress in the city with Colin Illard. If these things are not known and we can't really tell, why not create something that you could wear, a wearable, like on a Fitbit, put those monitors that you have for stress on a Fitbit or an Apple Watch or something like that?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic idea. And I think that we're beginning to see those kinds of applications emerging. So it wouldn't be a complicated thing for a device to measure skin conductance like we did, but there are other variables as well. Another important one is something called heart rate variability. So the healthier you are, the more your heart rate varies from time to time. And that's something that even some of the currently available gadgets can tell you. So what really needs to happen is to connect those kinds of measures to place, which again is a simple thing to do using a GPS signal, so that I could envision an app that people could use that could kind of map out their stress points in the city and advise them of places that maybe they should not spend too much time in.
Or if you crowdsource it, you advise everybody, you know? Everybody,
absolutely, they
could,
yeah.
Yeah, everybody would get your friends or whatever. We get notice that this is a stressful spot. Stay away.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, you write also about how the shape of a building can affect us. Tell us about the Lee Chin Crystal Building in Toronto.
The Lee Chin Crystal Building was a design by Daniel Libeskind that was an addition to a museum, which was kind of a stately old building in the Toronto landscape. And the Lee Chin Crystal is exactly what it sounds like. It's very crystalline. It's got sharp edges, really stark contours. And when it landed in Toronto, there was an unbelievable outcry about this monstrosity that had sullied the gentle Toronto landscape. I know that there was one pundit who described it as looking like a giant alien turd had landed in the middle of the city. And the building actually made the top 10 list of ugliest buildings several years in a row. And what people are responding to there is actually the geometry itself. People generally have aversive responses to any kind of object, including a building that has those kinds of sharp edges and sharp contours, and they much prefer to see curves.
So people really just get sick looking at the building.
Well, yeah, I don't know if they get sick or not, but they certainly have
get
these
stressed.
Unpleasant aversive. Yeah, yeah,
stressed by the building shape. It's just amazing. One of the most studied interior spaces are their casinos, right? How do casino designers play on our psychology to keep us gambling there?
Well, there are all kinds of tricks. I mean, ultimately, the game in a casino is to encourage people to spend as much time as possible with the gaming. These days, the big thing is the electronic gaming devices that are in casinos. Those are the big money makers. So the old school philosophy in casino design was basically to design low ceilings, narrow hallways, find ways to disorient people within the space so they basically become lost, and make it difficult for them to focus on anything other than the machines. These days, we're seeing the emergence of what you might call a playground casino. These kinds of things now are common in Vegas, for example, where the idea is to make you feel pleasant, to invite you into kind of a fantasy world, but to lure you in there again with kind of interesting tricks. So one of the things that you notice in these casinos is that they often have these nice, gently curving walkways that invite you into the space. And again, we like curves, so we like that. This is a principle that I find this kind of funny, that this is the same principle that's used now in the designs of abattoirs, so that animals being led to the slaughter don't actually feel too stressed on the way.
Being led to the slaughter is a good comparison.
Yeah. I think it is.
Yeah. We'll take a little break and we'll come back. It's just fascinating to listen to Colin Allard talk about how you react around the spaces around you. We'll take a break. We'll come back and talk lots more. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Support for this Science Friday podcast comes from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply, presenting The Message. How we missed it, no one knows, but now Nikki Tomlin, a PhD in linguistics from the University of Chicago, is working on deciphering it with her team of cryptologists at a research think tank called Cypher. Tomlin is trying to decode a message received from outer space 70 years ago, or so they think. This new 8-episode sci-fi podcast series blurs the line between reality and fiction, as the famous War of the Worlds radio broadcast did almost 80 years ago. Are we 70 years too late on deciphering the message? Why did the aliens reach out to us? Don't miss any of the details. Subscribe to this podcast from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply, called The Message, on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Again, that's The Message from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about how our city grids, storefronts, and streetscapes affect our bodies with Colin Allard. His new book is Places of the Heart, the Psychogeography of Everyday Life. We're talking about how casinos are hurting us, Temple Grandin-like, cattle through them in one direction. I know the supermarket, IKEA does that, doesn't it? It gets you going in all directions.
Yeah, absolutely. They do. They if you think about your IKEA experience, as it were, then one of the things that we all know is that we very quickly become lost in the space after a series of tricky twists and turns. We become, and that's deliberate, we become immersed in the story that IKEA is spinning out for us. And when we lose our bearings like that, we basically are, in a way, surrendering control of our lives to the merchandiser. And when we're in that kind of not necessarily unpleasant state of disorientation, we're much more likely to impulse buy.
Speaking of surrendering control of our lives, I'm glad you brought that up, because as a neuroscientist, do you worry about us relying less on maps and surrendering control to Siri and Google Maps telling us where to go? And, you know, we don't read maps anymore.
Yeah, I do. I do worry a bit about that for a number of reasons. One of them is that if you learn something about how we solve those kinds of spatial problems that involve finding our way from one place to another, there are basically two different routes that we can go. One of them involves learning a series of turns, just a series of left and right turns to get us from A to B. And the other one involves us representing where we are on some kind of mental map. And the over-reliance on GPS tends to force us into the first of those two methods rather than the second. And one of the reasons to be concerned about that is that the areas of the brain that are involved in that kind of map-based navigation, areas like the hippocampus and parts of the temporal lobe, are among the most vulnerable to things like dementing diseases, Alzheimer's disease. And so there is a school of thought that suggests that if we rely too much on technology and basically don't use as much of that part of the brain as we should, then we're putting it at risk for degeneration. And there's actually a little bit of imaging evidence that that kind of thing may be happening to some of us.
Wow. So take out that fold-up paper map and use it more.
Yep.
How hip are architects and urban designers to your research? Are they interested in this sort of thing?
Yeah, they are. There's a range of reactions. There is a group of architects and designers, and especially urban planners, who are keenly interested in the kinds of things that I think neuroscience can offer in the form of experiments like mine and those of many others. I think that a lot of good architects and good designers and good planners have an intuitive sense for what kinds of things work and what kinds don't. But mm-hmm. where they sometimes need some help is figuring out how to actually get the evidence, to make the hard-boiled case that one design as opposed to another is actually going to work.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think there's sometimes I pick up a little bit of anxiety from architects that I talk to, the concern being that if someone like me comes along and makes an evidence-based case for a particular kind of design as opposed to another, then that could represent a constraint on their freedom to be creative. I think that's something that can be negotiated, though, with goodwill on both sides and understanding. I think that there are ways that evidence-based principles like the ones that I'm working towards can fit nicely, can cohere with good creative architecture. It can be done.
Well, it certainly was an interesting walk. I'm glad you picked out some routes for me to take. I suggest everybody give this a try. It's quite interesting to get out of an urban location, just walk into a little pocket park, a little bit of greenery. Really does change your mood for that time that you're being there. My guest is Colin Ellard. What do you call yourself? What is the title that you...
I call myself a different name just about every day.
That's why I'm having trouble here.
Formally, I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, let's call me that today.
Well, we'll call you an author today because your new book is Places of the Heart, a really great book, Places of the Heart, the Psychogeography of Everyday Life. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Thanks
and you can read an excerpt from Places of the Heart and see pictures of my tour through the Lower East Side. It's on our website. Go to sciencefriday.com/streetscapes. In the Black Hills of South Dakota, not far from Mount Rushmore and the Gold Rush town of Deadwood, is the Homestake Mine. It's been decades since a single nugget of gold has been hauled up. But that doesn't mean there isn't treasure to be found in them thar hills. Physicists are working deep underground on the world's most sensitive particle detector in the hopes of finding dark matter. Our video producer Luke Roskin took a journey down the mine to film the Large Underground Xenon Experiment, or LUX. It's the subject of a new Science Friday documentary. That's right, we make those too. Which you can see now on our website at sciencefriday.com/darkmatter. Luke, good to see you.
Hi, Ira.
Also joining us is Richard Gatescale. He's a principal investigator on the LUX experiment and a professor of physics at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ira.
Luke, how far underground is this experiment?
It's 4,850 feet. It's almost a mile. It's a long ride down.
Take us down that ride.
Okay, so you go into the Sanford Underground Research Facility, and there's these two large yellow doors, and you go inside, and you're inside this rickety cage. That's the best way to describe it. They call it a cage with wood floors, and it's a rattly elevator, and your ears are popping the entire time, and you're getting rained on because there's water dripping down the mine. The water actually helps maintain the stability of the wood that's holding the shaft open. And it's about 10-15 minutes of this. It's a little bit terrifying. I'm going to go with terrifying.
I've been on one of them. I know what you mean.
And you get down when you finally get down to the bottom, you're greeted with a gold a mine. It's a big drift, what they call a drift, a wide cavern. And you circuit your way through there, and you go to basically what looks like a clean lab, a really clean lab with people in Tyvek suits, that we had to wash down all of our equipment, make sure there was no dust on it. And then you make your way through to the Davis Cavern. Now, that's the famous cavern where Ray Davis found or discovered the presence of neutrinos. So this is physics hallowed ground, and that's the home of LUX, the Large Underground Xenon Experiment.
And how does LUX work, and why does it have to be a mile underground?
Well, Lux is deep underground because it needs to be protected from cosmogenic rays. You have all these rays battering it or battering us when we're on the surface, and when you go mile underground, you're protected by that. Now, there's a whole bunch of other protections that are surrounding this detector that prevent all sorts of other sort of background radiation from getting inside.
Right. Let me talk to Dr. Gaitskill. Dr. Gaitskill. Is the fun in the chase, or would it be a lot more fun to actually find the dark matter?
There will be an enormous celebration in the cavern, I think, the day that we get direct evidence for dark matter. But this chase has been going on now for sort of 28 years, not just the Lux experiment, but precursors of this experiment.
Mm-hmm. And how long do you think you'll have to look for it?
That's always an interesting question to consider. I mean, the physics that drives this dark matter, this missing mass of the universe, includes some significant uncertainties. It's an entirely new type of physics. It's beyond anything that we currently know, beyond the standard model of particle physics, and as such is therefore able to sort of present many orders of magnitude for us to have to probe. So this has required a sort of very incremental approach, which, as I say, is we've been involved in over the last nearly three decades. Lux is now the best experiment in the world at looking for dark matter particles because of the scale that we've been able to do at the Sanford Underground Lab in South Dakota.
Now, Luke, I know you talked to a bunch of other scientists while you were down there about the long search for dark matter. What did you hear from them?
Well, I heard three big things. One is a really healthy sense of skepticism. This is a really hard search, and it's a really rare event for dark matter to interact with normal matter using the weak force. So all the researchers were extremely skeptical about you know, finding it, and skeptical about their data. So that was one thing. Another was pride, and maybe you heard a little of that from Dr. Gaitskill. They really have created the most quiet, radioactively quiet spot on Earth. And that's an achievement to be celebrated. And then the last is a sense of fun. So here's what Dr. Dan McKinsey, who's also a principal investigator on the experiment, had to say.
The thing about science is that it's true whether or not you believe it, and we have to ferret out that truth. You're not really having fun unless you're out to discover something new. At least that's true for me. And the fun is in the chase.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Gaitskill, what actually happens inside the xenon that's in there? How do you know when you've detected a dark matter?
Well, indeed, the ideal situation is nothing happens until a single dark matter particle happens. And then because it's science, we need to confirm that discovery. So another dark matter particle and then another. But the timescales between those interactions could be many weeks or months or even year. So this is why, as Luke was saying, we have to create an incredibly quiet environment within the middle of this detector and then watch it very carefully for these very occasional, what are postulated as very occasional interactions between a dark matter particle and a nucleus of xenon, this liquid xenon target that we have in the middle of the detector.
And how will you know when, if and when you get one?
So xenon has a property that it emits light. So it emits photons, say sort of 100 or so, in the event that one of these dark matter particles interacts. So what we're doing is using an array of photomultiplier tubes in order to detect these photons that are emitted and convert them into electrical signals that we, you know, digitize, record, and then you can actually see in real time these events coming in. But most are just due to the residual conventional radioactivity that we have in the detector, and not due to dark matter.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking about the Lux experiment with Richard Gaitskill and Luke Roskin. Now, Luke, what impact did you see? What is seeing all those scientists working for years and years on that experiment, what impact did that have on you?
Well, I mean, as somebody that works in media and documentaries, I am always looking for, you know, that eureka moment. And just to be clear, if you watch our documentary, you will get to see what that eureka moment will look like, would look like, hypothetically. But, you know, that's something that that isn't present in a lot of these researchers. They want to see that, but that's not what it's about for them. You know, this is, they really do have a very strong scientist ethic. And that strong scientist ethic where it's you want to get it right. You want to make sure that the data is actually showing that. That is more than just a vocation. That's a lifestyle almost, it felt like. And it means it was genuine. You could really tell it was genuine.
We wanted to let our listeners get a little bit of a feeling what it might be like to actually detect a particle. So we asked Ariel Zitch, our education manager, to create an experiment, a cloud chamber, right? An old-fashioned cloud chamber to watch her particles coming in from outer space?
You got it. You can do it this weekend. You can do it with a clear excited container, a little dry ice, and some isopropyl alcohol. And what really blew my pants off with this thing, which just like totally exploded my mind, is how many different kinds of particles you can see with the cloud chamber. This thing is the first cloud chamber was originally invented back in 1916. The guy won a Nobel Prize for it in 1927. But you at home can view the same background radiation that they're trying to avoid by burying the Lux detector in the bottom of the, you know, a mine.
And we have a video of how to do it, and you have instructions how to make it just with materials we can get.
Yep, it's all online at sciencefriday.com/cloudchamber.
Richard, what's next for Lux? Is it being upgraded? Does it need to be upgraded, updated a bit?
So right now we're in the middle of a search that's taking some year and a half, letting the detector run, looking for to see whether we can see some of these occasional events. But once we complete that run, in order to improve the sensitivity of the search, we need to scale everything up. So at Sanford Lab, we're going to be installing a detector that is 20 times bigger than the current Lux. And because of that, when it runs, a single day of that LZ detector, as we call it, will be the equivalent to an entire month of running of the current Lux detector. So that'll allow us either to study dark matter if we have discovered it, or if we haven't, it has this extra increase in sensitivity that allows us to search even more carefully for dark matter.
Mm-hmm. And Ariel, we don't have to wait for that to happen. We can make your cloud chamber.
You absolutely should. I mean, I think what these guys take for granted that everybody knows, right, is that there's radiation all the time, right? And it's a drag if you're looking for dark matter. It is just terribly cool if you want to learn about particle physics at home. The stuff that we're talking about really is frequent. It really can happen anywhere. And if you're fortunate enough to have a source of radiation nearby, like an old glow-in-the-dark watch or a smoke detector, you can actually see emissions.
What does it look like? You saw it. We have it on the video.
That's a great question. So what you create is this little chamber of mist, right? You create a super saturated alcohol environment. And so anytime an ionizing radiation particle barrels through that chamber, right, it leaves behind electrons, which create this little trail of mist. And they end up looking like these little ghostly jaunts throughout your cloud chamber. It's really quite pretty.
And sometimes they hit each other and you get little circular trails and
stuff? So depending on the type of particle that enters your chamber, you can actually see different things, right? So really massive particles or larger things like alpha particles that are these nuclei, they're just going to burrow right through there, leave a big long streak. But tiny things like electrons and positrons spin around and make all these cool curlicues.
Now it's up there on our website. And so is Luke's documentary. You can watch the documentary at our website at sciencefriday.com/darkmatter. I wanted to thank our guests, Richard de Gateskill. He's principal investigator on the Lux experiment, professor of physics at Brown University in Providence, Luke Raskin, a video producer, and Ariel Zitch, our education manager at Science Friday. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Charles Berkowitz is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lima is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, is our engineer at the controls here of our partners at the City University of New York. Calling all our fans in Minnesota, we're going to be visiting you in the Twin Cities in just a few weeks, live on stage at the Fitzgerald Theater on Tuesday, November 3rd. We're going to show you an ultrasonic glove that lets firefighters see through smoke, a ray gun that uncovers true colors of Vincent van Gogh. It's the science of superpowers like these on November 3rd at the Fitzgerald Theater. That's at Fitz Tickets. Believe me, they are going fast. So find out more at sciencefriday.com/Minnesota. Come on out and watch a live presentation of Science Friday and all our superheroes